Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is California Republican David Valadao, who joins us to discuss ag funding and the agenda on Capitol Hill. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of a pair of Idaho landowners and said their property does not constitute a wetland. The justices were unanimous in their opinion that the case should be returned to a lower court, but differed on the proper test for determining what exactly constitutes a water of the U.S. and be subject to the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. In a 5-4 decision, the court ultimately ruled that a wetland is covered under the law if it is indistinguishable from a regulated body of water and has a continuous surface connection to an existing WOTUS. USDA opened a new animal disease facility in Kansas. The National Bio and Agro Defense Facility opened its doors Wednesday, officially beginning the process of replacing the nearly 70-year-old Plum Island Animal Disease Center in New York. The facility is the first on American soil with the capability to study high-consequence zoonotic diseases on large livestock. USDA now takes control of the facility under a 2019 agreement with the Department of Homeland Security, which constructed the facility in Manhattan, Kansas, after a nationwide search for a location. And finally, the stalemate over debt ceiling negotiations had a direct impact on farm policy this week. House Appropriations Committee Chair Kay Granger postponed a markup of 4 appropriations bills as the talks lingered this week. One of those bills would fund USDA, FDA, and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Biden administration negotiators and House Republicans deliberated about the right approach to address the nation's debt ceiling, which federal officials say will be reached at the beginning of June. California Republican David Valadao sits on the House Appropriations Committee and the subcommittee charged with determining the federal government's ag and food spending. He says delaying the markup was the right call.
Well, the fight that we're having right now on the debt ceiling is the president and the other side of the aisle seem to be looking for a lot of shiny objects to point to distract away from what we should be focusing on, which is the debt ceiling right now. And so pushing it back, delaying it is the appropriate move. And if you look at what's happened over the last couple of years, even when the Democrats were in the majority, and we were doing full committee markups at the end of June, right before the July 4th recess. And so we're actually still ahead of schedule. We just delayed it by a little bit, and it has allowed the speaker the ability to focus on the debt ceiling, not allow the president to have something, some shiny object to point to and distract away, but actually have a conversation about what they need to be talking about.
So I want to ask about some specific things in that legislation. Specifically, Chairman Harris said on this program a couple of weeks ago that he was very focused on commodity credit core restrictions and restricting how the ag secretary can use that account. Where do you stand on that idea?
Well, and I'm a dairy farmer and still live on the dairy. And so for years, we watched the CCC come out and purchase products. And a lot of times it wasn't conducive to the marketplace. And so allowing the government to come in and just purchase product and put it on government warehouse shelves and hold it there, I mean, it still puts downward pressure on the marketplace. It still, I'd say, depressed farmer prices for a longer period of time than they probably should be. And so allowing the CCC just to play into the marketplace, a little bit dangerous. I think we should have a real actual market, and I think farmers would be a lot more successful if we allow the marketplace to do what it does. So I think there's going to be some restrictions there. I know that they play a role in making sure that some of our products will get it to food banks and others, and so we can allow that to happen and do it in a way that doesn't distort our market in a negative way.
Democrats on the committee see this idea and say, well, we were okay with this when MFP was going on during the Trump administration and CFAP and what have you, and now we're restricting it under a Democratic administration because they're doing things that the Republican majority doesn't agree with. Your thoughts on that line of
thinking? Well, when that was going on during the COVID situation, I had reached out, and I wasn't in office at the time, but I reached out to the USDA, some friends in there, and I had mentioned, like, if you're going to buy product, don't just put on government warehouses. Buy the product and get it out to food banks, get it out so it's actually being consumed. Because as long as the product is in existence, it's going to put downward pressure on the farmer price. And we want to make sure farmers are as successful as possible. And so if they do get involved, we want them to do it in a way that allows the product to be consumed and used and off the market, off the shelves. The government warehouses where a lot of dairy products and other products end up in, those are publicly reported very often, and so they're there, they're in existence, they're able to come in and put a pressure on the market, and they'll continue to put pressure on the market. And so we have to make sure that we have a true and honest marketplace.
Another idea in this legislation is an increase of the able-bodied adults without dependents age up to 55 from the current 49. We see that in other areas as well, the debt ceiling negotiations. There's a farm bill, marker bill that's been introduced on the subject. Why the push and why the priority within the Republican conference on this idea?
Well, I think it's important to get people back to work. And we're talking about folks who have no children and are not disabled. They have the ability to work. And there's no reason why they shouldn't be a part of the workforce. There's no reason why they shouldn't be productive members of society. And so to give that extra pressure to put people back into the workplace, I mean, you look at any industry out there, if it's agriculture to hospitality to even construction, all the other industries, we're all struggling to find folks. And there's a lot of talk about H-2A and H-2B and all the different type of guest worker programs, which I'm very supportive of. But we also have to make sure that Americans are playing a vital role and showing up to work and being a part of our economy and not being just holding back and taking taxpayer dollars to sit at home. So I think it's important. And again, the most important part is these are people who have no children and are not disabled. So we got to clarify that so people understand that there's really no excuse for these people not to go to work.
We'll be right back to talk water issues with Congressman Valadao right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahe build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back. This week's news of water usage reductions from California, Arizona, and Nevada is welcome news, but California Republican David Valadao says more can be done for producers in his area.
We've already got a very small amount of water that we're always fighting for, and you've got communities and agriculture all struggling to get enough water before it goes out to the ocean, and it'll add pressure. So as they lose some of that Colorado River going into Southern California, they'll start to look for other places to take water from and compete with us. And farmers in the Central Valley are already struggling with LA and a lot of the southern communities there with a lot more money to be able to pay prices that farmers just can't justify the expense on. So what we need to do is we need to invest in more infrastructure, I mean more water storage. And some of that is going to be reservoirs, some of that's going to be below ground storage. That's going to be rules and regulations that allow us to move water through the Delta. Like my water bill, one of the things that we focus on is implementing the 2019 biological opinions that allows real-time monitoring of what's going on in the Delta, allows us to be able to move more water south of the Delta. That'll give us more water to trade amongst farmers in the community so that people have water at their faucets, but also we as farmers have water to grow commodities.
Your district, like many other parts of California right now, not necessarily dealing with water shortage, but water abundance as flooding has hit your neck of the woods pretty hard. What can you tell us about what that has meant to producers in your area?
So like you said, we went through a few years of drought. And so it's not uncommon to drive around the valley and see wells pulled out of the ground. I drove by one the other day that there was a pile of sand on it, alongside of it. So you know that that well's probably got some major damage done to it. I mean, we've had some issues with very, very little water, entire communities out of water. We've got probably about 2,000 domestic systems out there that have tanks and pumps and water being trucked in so that people have water at their houses or in their communities. I mean, the water situation has gotten very, very dramatic. And then turn to this year, we've got record snowfall, the most in recorded history, and it's melting at a pace that we hope to manage. But it's flooded out a few rivers. We've had some levees break. We've had some communities underwater. We've got an entire community that's underwater. We're increasing a levee height right now, 14-mile levee that protects the city of Corcoran, 14,000 residents and 9,000 inmates at the Corcoran prison, and Stratford's another community. So all this water is going down these existing waterways, and it's brought back the Tulare Lake, and we've got thousands of acres layers underwater. The threat is if that snow melts too fast, those waterways won't be able to handle it, and we'll have more levee breaks, and we could potentially have a problem with some more communities either threatened or actually underwater.
Can't let you go without asking about your farm bill priorities. That legislation due to be reauthorized yet this year. What's your wish list as Congress looks at that?
Well, we've really got to look into the crop insurance stuff. My area of California has a lot of specialty crops, so we want to make sure that a specialty crop has access to good crop insurance programs. The ones that have already been implemented work very well. I want to look at the dairy side of things a little bit more. We've got some priorities for that. I'd like to see something if GT will adapt or adopt. We'd like to look at some sort of H-2A program. The guest worker program is a big deal for us. Community rural projects, making sure that we're investing in conservation projects. All those types of things are important. I mean, obviously, we've got a lot of water this year, but those dry years that we know will come in the valley, making sure that we have the ability to irrigate our crops in an efficient way and be able to use whatever water resources we have efficiently. I mean, all those things are a big priority for me, so we're going to continue to work hard on it.
Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel, but first, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at a key part of the Farm Bill for many producers in this week's Farm Bill Focus.
Title 10 of the Farm Bill focuses on horticulture. The horticulture title was added to the Farm Bill in 2008 and focuses primarily on what we call specialty crops. Think fruits, vegetables, and tree nuts, as well as organic agriculture. One of the biggest changes in the entire 2018 Farm Bill was in the horticulture title, which included provisions to regulate production of industrial hemp under federal law. Elsewhere in Title 10, the Specialty Crop Block Grant Program supports specialty crops through grants totaling up to $85 million per year. States can receive a base grant plus an additional grant determined by the acreage and value of specialty crops in that state. The 2018 Farm Bill also changed USDA's organic certification process to fund technology upgrades and limit fraud in the program. Another key aspect of the title is support for farmers markets and local food promotion through efforts like the Local Agriculture Market Program. The 2018 Farm Bill also created an Office of Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production at USDA. The title receives less than 1% of Farm Bill spending, but many specialty crops are also eligible for more support in some of the other titles. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Who's the number one protein source in chicken feed? You are. Who just increased sales to Egypt by 700%? You did. Who made a huge deal with Goodyear? You again. Take a victory lap. When you pool your resources through your soy checkoff, you're making sales. You're making breakthroughs that all come back to your bottom line. That's you. That's who. As your soy checkoff. Moving soy forward. Moving you forward.
It's not as simple just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we are joined by a couple of folks that are going to discuss with us issues facing producers in the western part of the United States and specialty crop growers really throughout the country. Joined this week by Dennis Nuxel with Western Growers and Sarah Niagu-Reed with American Hort. Appreciate both of you taking the time to join us. And Dennis, I want to go to you first, because obviously we saw some big news at the beginning of the week, a longstanding issue, not only in western farm policy, but in western policy writ large, the Colorado River situation. And we saw some resolution there. With California and some other states coming to the table with reduction ideas. What do you think this ultimately means for the grand scheme of Colorado River debates, and what is this going to mean for producers in the region?
Well, you know, we don't quite have full visibility on what's going to happen in the Colorado River, because some of the details haven't been released, and some of the details may not have yet all been worked out. But obviously quite critical to try to bolster Lake Mead and make sure we don't get to Deadpool in Lake Mead, where we can't generate power in the dam there. But you know, this is going to, I suspect, be a reoccurring issue. I think even when you look at the press releases and the press conferences that have occurred in the last couple of days since that announcement, I think everybody concedes that, in 2 or 3 or 4 years, we're going to have to come back and do another round of this. And this is not the permanent solution. This is a good interim step. And we're probably going to have to come back at this in 2 or 3 years as well.
So looking at this from a water rights standpoint, what does it mean in your mind that states came to the table and brought suggestions as opposed to a federal government idea ultimately being the what happened here?
Well, I think that's what all of us want. I think all of us want local control. All of us want state governments to engage with each other to come up with voluntary solutions rather than having the federal government impose a solution. So at least from my perspective, I think having a voluntary agreement is the right move, and I welcome it.
Sarah, I want to bring you into the fold here and start talking about labor issues, obviously so critical to producers throughout the country, specialty crop producers and horticulture producers in particular. We saw a new survey, a new report from USDA this week saying that farmers across the country had given their workforce about a 5% raise over the course of the last year. Wondering, what has that higher cost meant for the horticulture industry and its consumers?
That report was really reflecting the dynamics we're up against. HTA usage is on the rise, but by no means is anybody very overjoyous about having to partake in the program. In fact, I hear more about kicking and screaming because of the scarcity issue and what it's resulted in them having to lean on this foreign guest worker program. But when it comes to the first conversation I have with our growers about the highest input costs, it's always labor.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
The Senate and House Ag Committees are busy working on the next Farm Bill, which will cover commodities, specialty crops, livestock, and more. This legislation will impact every farmer, rancher, and rural business for the next 5 years. Make sure you don't miss insights and analytics that only AgriPulse and its top-notch team of well-connected experts can provide. Register today for a free trial at agripulse.com and click the subscribe button, or email us at pam@agri-pulse.com. You don't want to miss this Farm Bill coverage.
Welcome back. Organizations representing specialty crop producers are pushing for automation research funding in the upcoming Farm Bill. Sarah Niagu-Reed with American Hort says it would be a good start.
We're always looking for every congressional session to move and take action on ag labor reform so that we can have some sort of immediate remedy. But now we're thinking long term. And in fact, this isn't the first Farm Bill, but it's the first Farm Bill that we're proposing something of this, this sort. A standalone mechanization research proposal. And the request itself is honestly a drop in the bucket, because research and development surrounding technology of this sort takes many, many years and is very expensive. So with the $20 million asked mandatory spending, we foresee that setting ourselves up for the future, because we cannot be in this sort of status quo for the coming years. And we can't wait for another Farm Bill either. We have to start investing more and more dollars, working in public-private partnerships so that we can have this form of technology. You know, last year, the green industry conducted a survey of our members throughout the nation. And one of the points that came back from the survey was that nearly half of the surveyed growers started using a new labor-saving technology during 2021. But with that said, those are only the individuals who have access to something of that sort. And it's very small pool, but I think that data point indicates that everyone is willing and ready to invest in that type of technology if it's there. So we need this sort of program to get us there.
Well, and a lot of this technology is going to be very, very expensive, not only to produce, but then ultimately to purchase once the research does bring a product to commercialization. I say all that to ask, a $20 million a year ask in the Farm Bill, Is that sufficient, or where do you think this investment, you know, will ultimately need to go?
Yeah, well, you bring up another proposal, and we're hoping that at some point through this farm bill process, these two will go hand in hand. But we are asking for two things. One is the standalone research initiative that we just discussed at $20 million in mandatory spending a year, and that's to invest in the R&D. But to implement and to allow for growers to have access and be able to afford this type of technology once it's on the market, we're looking at a cost share sort of mechanism. And this would go, like I said, hand in hand, because as these products come to market, the investment itself is going to be very expensive for growers, but in the long term, set them up for success. So they will need some assistance in that way. And that's why the second proposal that we're looking at for mechanization is a cost share sort of idea.
Dennis, I want to wrap up our conversation with you and sticking with that farm bill theme. So many folks looking at changes to risk management programs in this upcoming farm bill, including producers of fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, those specialty crops as they are defined in legislation, wondering what are some changes that your members are going to be pursuing through this next farm bill to the crop insurance program?
So for special crop growers, we're in an interesting position because there are some of our community who have crop insurance policies. There's about 75 specific crops that have an RMA crop insurance policy. But there are hundreds of more crops that have no coverage at all. So what we have presented to Congress is a set of ideas that would help us create more crop insurance products for our industry and make it easier for us to engage in crop insurance conversations. And so for example, how do we look at different causes of loss? If there is a E. coli outbreak of, let's say, strawberries, and that makes national news, that can tend to crash markets. And so as a consequence, many of our growers are interested in making sure that something like a food safety event and the revenue loss caused by a food safety event, that would be a covered cause of loss. And right now, that's not clear that is a covered cause of loss. And that's something, for example, that we're looking to Congress to help us clarify.
So many people looking for changes in this upcoming farm bill, including producers in the western part of the United States and throughout the country, growing those specialty crops so critical to dinner plates across the country. Dennis and Sarah, thanks for joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers, but first, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at the economic situation in the cattle industry in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
There may be tough times ahead for meat processors due to economic shifts in the beef sector. Two primary factors are contributing to the sea change: a smaller beef cattle herd across the country and a significant increase in live cattle prices. This chart shows beef cattle prices in the U.S. from the beginning of 2012 to March 2023. Prices have been steadily increasing since 2021 and show no signs of slowing down due to a contraction in American cattle inventory. The U.S. beef herd shrank to just over 89 million head of cattle and calves in January. That's the lowest since 2015 and a 3% drop from a year earlier. An economist from Oklahoma State University says the cutbacks were partially made due to droughts throughout cattle country and have directly resulted in higher beef prices and more competition for animals between processors. The tough economic climate has many plans to expand or build new processing capacity on hold. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Register now for the 2023 AgriPulse Food and Ag Issues Summit in California. The event will offer participants a full day of presentations and panel discussions. You can hear from members of the California Legislature, food and agriculture leaders, along with industry experts and academics. The summit takes place on June 5th at the Sheraton Grand Sacramento and through our virtual experience. View the latest information and register today under the Events tab at agripulse.com.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. The Senate is scheduled to be in session on Tuesday following Monday's Memorial Day holiday to honor fallen service members. And time is running out to sign up for the June 5th AgriPulse Food and Ag Issues Summit in Sacramento. You can still register under the Events tab at agripulse.com. We'll have the latest farm policy news throughout the week online at agripulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one. Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit agripulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.